Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
So welcome to Speaking of Reliability. My name is Chris Jackson.
And I'm Fred Schenkelberg. And thanks for joining us. We really appreciate those that have come back over and over again to hear this banter that we do. And if it's your first time, it's a discussion among friends about reliability. And it's a couple of folks that like to talk shop. And the show is about that premise. We often work alone as reliability engineers or in isolation versus among all these other engineers. And so this little show is for us to talk shop. And so, Chris, you mentioned as we were getting ready for this today that, and I saw just a piece of it on the news the other day, that the Soyuz rocket heading to the space station aborted. And the two astronauts, or an astronaut and a cosmonaut, to be correct, landed safely back on Earth.
Yeah, it's very topical because we're all about space programs these days, and SpaceX and a bunch of other companies and NASA are building rockets. So it's whenever something bad like this happens, it's always good to learn from.
Well, it's one of those failures that the Soyuz rockets don't do that very often. They're sort of like an airplane almost, because I don't remember the last time. I'm sure they've had failures, but I can't remember the last time they've had an abort or an explosion or a problem with their rockets.
Well, that's true. They're easily the most reliable rockets in terms of operational history, where you'd expect 95% is par for a reliable rocket. And the Soyuz rocket is one of the most reliable things going around in that industry. It's important to point out there's a Soyuz rocket and there's a Soyuz spacecraft, which is the bit that sticks on the end of the rocket. So we're not talking about the spacecraft itself. The spacecraft worked fine. In fact, it was the spacecraft's emergency landing system which saved the lives of the astronaut and cosmonaut on board. So it's the actual rocket itself, which failed. The booster failed to fire, I believe. Mm-hmm. But yeah, notwithstanding it's different to the Soyuz spacecraft, it is the most reliable rocket we know.
Well, I remember vaguely seeing something about Elon Musk went to try to buy, but I think he was trying to buy ICBMs for his space program from the Russians at one point, and said, you know, that's not a good deal. I'll go make my own. And he is.
Yep.
But Soyuz has got a long history, though. They've been making these. And the part I'm fascinated by when it's a big, complicated machine that you're not going to get 25 of them to go test to failure. You do various bits and pieces. So it's a whole strategy and we run into it with all kinds of products that you're just not going to get a bunch of samples. And maybe the first time it's ever put together is when you finally get one to sell. I know the bit I understand about the Soyuz rocket is it's about as simple a rocket as they can get. It's not fancy in any means, but it's rugged. And that seems to be a general approach for the Russian design teams, is just make it robust. Just make it solid.
Yeah, the space workhorse. It's also important to know that in the context of this conversation, the Soyuz spacecraft and rocket they launched before the space shuttle was even a thing. Mm-hmm. And today they're the only way that astronauts can get into space. So that says something about what these systems are and what they do and how they work. There are some case studies of exceptionally poor systems coming out of the former Soviet Union, but this appears to be a success story in terms of reliability.
Well, that's what makes that difference, though, and this is going to be conjecture, right? A few episodes ago, we talked about the Russian version of the Concorde and just how much of a disaster that was. Mm-hmm. The Soyuz rocket was probably part of the Cold War get to the moon kind of stage and be part of the space programs. And so they've been around for quite a while. I don't think it was the same ones they were launching in the 80s or in the 60s. Yet it has had a long longevity, which speaks to it has a lot of capability. It can take the various payloads that are available to the, and do it economically. So that it's mm-hmm. worth doing. But what would,
yeah,
you know, there's a difference though in how they go about creating that system. And I think it's a management difference, is my conjecture, especially when we compare it to the Concorde, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, I suppose one of the differences between the Russian Concorde, sorry, the Tu-144 and the Soyuz is that in the case of the Tu-144, they weren't, it was a geopolitical statement at the height of the first part of the Cold War, and they were not allowed to leverage off technologies that had existed. Where the Concorde was a British-French collaboration that could tap into US-based technologies, the Tu-144 certainly could, but it had to keep up with a program that could. Mm-hmm. Now, that wasn't the case with spacecraft in the 1960s. You had the Soviet Union primarily versus the United States primarily. And even though they were making geopolitical statements, there was not a huge, there's not a plethora of spacecraft expertise across the world that one country or the other wasn't able to tap into.
Right.
So they were competing against each other in both purely developmental timeframes, not having to have the Tu-144 try and beat a well-resourced, highly collaborative Anglo-French Concorde, and no doubt one of the reasons it failed. So perhaps there's something to be said for that that historical lesson in regards to the system. It wasn't competing with a better funded, better or more collaborative, or just to say more enabled design process when trying to meet deadlines.
Yeah, and the space programs, I know, in both countries were well funded because mm-hmm. of the ability, one, the geopolitical statements, but also just the exploration of space and part of the process of doing that. It was a lot of unknowns. And so, mm-hmm. but it gets back to that notion of, well, you know, if a product is, it makes the news when it fails, like the one recently, right? Mm-hmm. How do you create and design a system that really you don't want it to be in the news? And the Soyuz rocket has been successful at that for decades. How do you design something like that? How do you go about creating that? So the comparison to the Concorde is that, well, don't do it that way. That's another episode, right? But this one is, you know, it's I don't think the Russians, I mean, I know that there's rocket tests and there's rocket launches with dummy payloads and low risk things. But even when you get to that stage, you pretty much have to make sure it works. There's a lot of work that goes prior to that. And I'm thinking of the projects that you and I work on, not space mm-hmm. programs necessarily, but things that are relatively high risk, complicated enough and expensive enough that you have to use a different approach to go about doing it, and where failure is catastrophic. Sometimes you can't even, it's very, very difficult to know exactly what went wrong. Imagine with the current booster failure is that, I wonder if it was onboard telemetry that said, oh, that's what the failure is. I doubt that they have a primary cause yet.
Yep.
Being so soon. And I wonder if they will, depending on how it failed, how it came back down.
Well, I think, I was watching a trailer for the movie that's coming out, First Man, which chronicles Neil Armstrong and others' mm-hmm. First landing on the moon. And one phrase stuck with me when I was listening to Ryan Gosling's little excerpts from across the movie. And one of the things he said is that we need to fail down here so we don't fail up there. And I think it goes back to one of the principles I know you harp on, Fred, mm-hmm. is that you would every failure is, from a learning perspective, is absolutely gold. So if you can make it happen in the laboratory or in your prototype, that's what you want to do. And you have those organizations which understand that and encourage it. And you have those that are trying to have zero failures during development, which essentially just kicks the can down the road because you're going to have failures.
That's right.
It just means you're going to have it during operations. So I think that perhaps, you know, when you, it's all those things you say, you have to have an organization which is really trying to make it fail in a safe environment before it has to do what it needs to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen the rocket tests and used to be a lab here in the Bay Area. It was in its own little valley, well away from the population. But when they would run a rocket test, you see this huge cloud of the steam, essentially. They dump tons of water onto the exhaust and you get this cumulus nimbus cloud growing across the ridge, and you could hear the roar of those engines being fired. And I don't think they do it locally here anymore. They've moved it off to some even more remote place. But it's, so they can fire the rockets, they can test the fuel systems, they can test valves and all these other parts to it. But in those tests, those rockets are just bolted down to the ground, essentially. Mm-hmm. And they're measuring all kinds of things doing that, but it's not the same when it's gets all of the vibration that it's going to see when it's standing or and heading into space. It's freestanding. So my point is that sometimes failures are pretty darn dangerous. You don't want to be anywhere near these things when they fail. There's that whole show of MythBusters.
Sometimes failure is always an option.
That's right, and they're always standing a little. They stand quite a further away in the later episodes than they did in the early episodes. I think their insurance guy said, "No, you guys got to move the cameras further away."
Absolutely.
But I think you're right. It's in a development process, but how do you prove? Now, here's the question I always have a problem with. Like, they have these liquid fuel rockets and there's valves and you got to get certain flow rates at certain speeds. How do you, and the valve itself is, you know, a mechanical or electrical mechanical device. How do you know that that one is going to work without destroying it, without making it fail, and then you don't have one to put on the rocket?
I think that at the end of the day, you never know that it will. I mean, it's always, you have to deal with uncertainties. As you know, there are things you can do that's called, in a practical sense, you know that if you do this activity, it will likely have this benefit. But it's just funny, though, that there's a sports saying that the harder I practice, the luckier I got. And I think the same thing applies in designing things to be reliable. There are certain things you do that we know will decrease the chance of failure. But you're without absolutely ever knowing. Tiger Woods, at the peak of his powers, he could never go to a tournament. Even if he was the overwhelming favorite, you could never say he was absolutely going to win. Mm-hmm. You never could.
Right.
But he was, at that time, the most dominant golfer in the world, and you'd be a silly person to bet against him. But you could never say with absolute certainty, and that's the unfortunate space that engineers need to live in when it comes to reliability, and that's inherently uncomfortable.
Yeah. And we do stuff like design margins and adding the stress strength calculations types of things. Mm-hmm. We over-design to some extent to account for that uncertainty or variability that's not accounted for in the system. Maybe do material studies looking at how it behaves under the extreme pressures or extreme temperatures, things like that, and see if we lose the material property that we're counting on, that could lead to a catastrophic failure. But at the end of the day, we got to just test it oftentimes. And it's not anything that's going to be statistical, where we just don't have that enough of those to really know.
Well, and you compare it to the space shuttle, for example. I mean, the Soviet design team for the Soyuz system, if you count the spacecraft and the rocket as a single system, included an emergency landing abort process. That is, if something happened like it did recently for the Soyuz rocket launch, the spacecraft itself has the ability to detach from the rocket and land safely on Earth. Mm-hmm. Where compare that to the space shuttle, where it was assumed arbitrarily that the space shuttle was reliable enough that there was no need to have some sort of detachable crew module during launch to deal with some sort of launch anomaly, like the Challenger disaster of 1986. Mm-hmm. This was an arbitrary decision based on not much, and you can almost sense the reason why they made that chose that, because it saves money and it saves schedule.
Well, it's hard to say NASA saves money. They spend compared to the private programs, they're spending tons of money. I think it added complexity, and it was a trade-off, to be fair, to the NASA folks. I know they do a lot of work to understand, and they do a lot of probabilistic risk assessment is a tool they use pretty frequently, down to the individual nuts and bolts and so on. It gets into some detail, and then they say, well, if we add this much complexity that you can blast off the crew module, and land it safely, it adds these components, and that adds another level of complexity and failure mechanisms. What if those seals fail and so on? What's the chance of that getting right versus the, I think they also counted on that if it got to enough altitude, I don't know whether it had a way to detach from the main rocket, that big central cylinder, until it got to sufficient orbit. I think that's what you're talking about. It didn't have a way to detach until it was meant to. If it there wasn't a blast away from it and then glide back down. And I think they counted on that there was such a short duration between, if you're only 100 feet up from the ground, you can't glide away. The parachute won't help you, right? But if you're in low orbit, then you can glide back down. I don't know if the space shuttle would ditch very well. I think that would be that would be a problem. It's
that's right. But I mean, that they actively considered it though. For it, and when we talk about the 1970s, where NASA was really, to be honest, the space shuttle was full of compromises. Mm-hmm. They over promised, they under delivered. Back in the 1970s, they still had the Apollo era ethos and the delusions of grandeur that they had. That stemmed over from the success of the Apollo missions.
Right.
They just didn't have the money, but they were promising that they could do these things. You could even go back to the whole premise of the space shuttle, which was to be fully reusable, which they never got to. They had to have these external fuel tanks. So there was all these compromises being made. But it says something, I think, about the design process, where the Soyuz system is a lot simpler. And it has a lot more redundancy, and that redundancy built in the 1960s has saved the lives of astronauts and cosmonauts in the 2000s. I think that says something about the design culture at the time as well.
Yeah. No, and there's something to be said for, get a good working design and stay with it, and then don't cost reduce it. Don't thin it out. And I'm sure there's pressure to do that, right? There's why do we need these walls so thick? We could shave another ton off of the rocket and increase payload. Mm-hmm. I have any idea how the Soyuz is developed and evolved over time. Yet when you get a system that works, and you don't understand the margin, and you don't understand why it's working, it's dangerous to start fiddling with it. Unless you really get into the details of it. But even there, there's so many variables, so many ways that the variation of what we're dealing with can lead to failure. And so it's, if you get one that works, step in and repeat, mm-hmm. especially for these large complex systems.
And not to unnecessarily dump on the space shuttle program, let's be clear, the two main failures the space shuttle program had, which was the Challenger and the Columbia, happened in 2003. Both the failure mechanisms were well known for at least a decade in each case. Mm-hmm. They were, in the case of the space shuttle, the engineers knew it was just going to fail one day, but got overridden by management. For Columbia, it was, again, a lot of managers assumed that the foam strike issue, which caused the disintegration in orbit, was non-existent, and they had these, again, the similar in-flight waivers that allowed that essentially allowed the Columbia to launch in the middle of an investigation regarding the foam strike damage on the leading edge of wings. So they're in the middle of an investigation which hadn't finished yet about that very failure mechanism which destroyed the Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
So I take your point. These are developmental systems, but if you really want to look hard enough, you will find the dominant failure mechanisms, and it's all about how you as an organization deal with them. If you try to pretend they don't exist, then failure is inevitable. But if you actually encourage your organization to try and test the failure, you get different outcomes. And I think your experience bears this out as well.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's something I want to talk some more about, but I suspect it's probably a topic for another whole episode. We should save that. I think we're lining ourselves up for our next episode. We just talked ourselves into a topic here.
Inadvertently.
Well, a little bit design there. but as a listener, you know, and I know that we have folks listening from all kinds of industries and all kinds of backgrounds and so on, I think the real key question is are you designing to and developing and exploring how your system fails, or are you designing and creating systems and test programs that really only focus on the success part? And then how's that pan out? And I don't know anybody will take us up on that, because we'd have to make sure we stay out of the proprietary stuff. And a lot of people loathe talking about field disasters and those kind of things. But in general, I'm curious if that is a strong correlation into program successes. Now, in my own experience, I have my own take on that. We'll talk about that later. But if you would like to join that conversation and let us know what you think, we'd certainly love to hear from you. If you head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, there's a ways to form there and a variety of ways to get in touch with us. And as you know, many times our topics and ideas that we discuss on the show are with that person's comments or feedback or insights as part of the conversation. So if you'd like to join us in the show, essentially or virtually, is let us know your thoughts and comments. We'd love to hear from you. So with that, Chris, I think we're planning on recording the next episode pretty quick. So people have less than no time to get to us on this episode, but we'll certainly follow up with any comments we do here. Yeah, because this episode's not coming out for a couple of weeks. And so this calling in now would not affect our next episode. So it's really not fair to do that, is it?
And we actually might know more about why the rocket fails, which makes some of our conversation maybe redundant.
Yeah, no, we'll find out some more info, and then we can get some insights from other folks. That would make a really good episode, I think. So, yeah, cool. All right. Well, thanks, Chris. We'll chat with you soon.
No worries, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.